Welcome to Hot Plate, a post-foodie podcast. I'm your host, Mirella Amato. Today on Hot Plate, gorilla grafters, community fridges, splattering food, and nibbling on ice cream. How are you doing, Joshna?
I am pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm fine. The garden is planted.
Oh, that's exciting. That's a hopeful, nice thing.
Mm-hmm. It always feels good.
Yeah. There's a bit of like wealth and promise and hopefulness. That's really nice.
And this year we started from, because there was nothing else to do, started from seed. Usually I buy plants.
You buy little plants? Okay.
But we decided to delve into our little seed stash. So it's doubly satisfying.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
You know, to have seen the plants go from nothing.
Babies, oh, cracking those little babies open and the little eggshelly business on the inside is, it's very nice.
And then sort of acclimating them to the, starting growing them inside and then taking them outside every day. It's like this little, it's a different bonding
little
level.
Weaning in, indeed. All right. Well, listen, speaking of growing, I found this bit that I am really excited about. And so I thought I'd bring it to our conversation. It's this wonderful idea of gorilla grafters. So essentially, these lovely people are grafting fruit trees onto ornamental trees in cities. And essentially what this means is a piece of a fruit tree is then literally attached to, they say it's a sort of tongue and groove mechanism. And then they tape them up and they monitor them to see about, growth and viability. But essentially the initiative is about food security, but there's clearly so much more involved about claiming space, having a commentary on why we have so many ornamental plants in cities and why we don't think about planting, plants that actually produce food, considering levels of food insecurity. How did it strike you? What do you think about it?
I do like the gorilla nature of it. And this idea of, changing the environment, taking control of the environment and embellishing the environment is definitely something that I'm very pro. This being said, I just felt this particular approach was not one that, speaking from someone who has had fruit trees and has had to maintain fruit trees, most notoriously a fig tree, which... I don't know if you've seen the mess a fig tree makes.
I have.
If you don't
harvest,
pick those
figs
on time and they all cake to the pavement. I just feel like this particular initiative is not really sustainable. Like the trees are there to clean the air. And there's a reason why they plant trees that don't bear fruit, because then someone has to pick the fruit or clean the sidewalk. And it is my understanding that this organization does try to monitor and pick the fruit, but I feel like this is just essentially setting up a problem that someone else is going to have to deal with. And B, I really don't feel personally that if I was walking down the street and one of the trees along the streets just randomly was growing an apple, that I would in all confidence think, oh, there's an apple, and grab that
here's
fruit.
A snack. Yeah.
And, there are a lot of other similar initiatives, like not far from the tree or these other things that you pointed out, that I think are taking a much smarter approach that is more sustainable and that, has some follow through.
It's totally fair. Perhaps what they need to do is partner with an organization like Not Far From the Tree that monitors and harvests fruit. So at least there's a follow through there on that, right?
But even then, what are they going to say? Like, okay, walk three blocks, pick these three apples, then drive five blocks that way, and there should be a pair or two on that tree.
It's true. It's true. It's just one branch worth of fruit is different than an entire tree worth. I hear you. This is sensible reasoning. This is sensible. I'll play along here.
I love the spirit
here.
Behind it, but I just feel like it wasn't thought out.
There was some talk about the fact that this perhaps is best understood as some sort of gardening graffiti.
Yeah.
right? And if you understand that and eliminate the need for it to be a legitimate food security initiative, it's perhaps a bit more palatable.
But let's talk about these other initiatives, which are
yes.
Fantastic.
So Not Far From the Tree is a favorite of mine. I've been connected to them for a while, and they are wonderful. Founded by a lovely woman named Laura Rainsborough, who saw the mess, the crime scene on the ground, right? Apricots in this city do a mighty fine job of messing up a sidewalk.
Cherries, too.
It's like a crime scene for sure, right? With the red sort of splatter of it all. And so what Laura came up with is this idea where volunteers would, like a homeowner who had this unwieldy fruit tree, would connect with this organization, would pair them with a volunteer team that goes out to pick all of the fruit. And then a third of the fruit stays with the homeowner, a third goes to the volunteers who do the work, and the remaining third gets shared with a community organization.
See, that I can get behind.
Yeah. It is Not Far From the Tree proper is just Toronto. There are other sort of fruit gleaning organizations around the world, really. I think there's European ones and many in our friends in the States. Not Far From the Tree is just Toronto and just a section, because from the last time I checked in and understood, they were also exclusively bike powered.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so that really sort of that informs the spread in the distance that they can move on these trailer bikes with the big picker poles and all of it. I have to say, I've been on a few picks and it is the most joyful thing, right? When you can reach up and yank that down and then you see the big basket that you're left with and everybody's lugging home their beautiful bags of pears.
Not only that, but it's something some people pay to do, right? You can pay to go apple picking we live in a city here. It's like a paid privilege to do these things.
And it is a seasonal ritual for many, yeah.
So I think in that sense, we could say it's a win-win in all three directions.
Indeed.
It's a win.
Indeed.
Just such a beautiful initiative. And I know certainly locally there's another initiative. There were a few years there where I was just traveling so much I couldn't plant my garden, and my brother-in-law told me there's another organization in Toronto that if you have a patch of earth that you're not using, they will come in and plant.
Yes,
and
yes.
Do similar work where they'll give the landowner sounds like such a charged term.
It's true, right?
The person whose garden patch it is, can we agree on that? They'll give them part of the food, and then they'll take part of the food again to communities. And this is fresh food to communities in need. So such wonderful initiatives.
Yeah. In fact, our friends at The Stop were doing something like this, and they called it YIMBY, which is yes in my backyard.
Oh, nice.
Right. Which I thought was quite adorable. Right. People being like, yes, I have extra space. Come use it, grow some food and share it with everybody. And of course, to this point, if we really want to talk food security, these are the strategies that we need. Okay, Mirella, have you heard the term hyper-local food security?
Nope, this is new.
It's super new to me. And so I heard about it in the context of community fridges. Right, so
which are also new to me.
Yes, it was new to me too. We've seen community libraries, these sweet little things in front of people's, right, for sharing of books. And I've even seen a few community pantries with some non-perishable stuff that can hang out, which is a lovely gesture. But now we're talking community fridges. Right. And the one in the piece that I shared sort of happened by accident, where a dude just this guy had surplus food that he just wanted to keep fresh. And then the community need kind of emerged around it. But to me, it seems like a dream. It seems like a really beautiful way for people to share food.
It really is. And I have to say, and the gentleman who first put out the fridge acknowledged this as well, that the first thought is like, how is this gonna turn out? Just putting a fridge full of food out there, is that just gonna lead to, you know, mass confusion and
madness of some sort, right?
And I think the thing I love most is how well this is working.
I know, it's really quite a beauty. I mean, it. I think to some degree is testament of the fact that we could trust people. Specifically hungry people to manage a thing and to manage a resource well, right? It's, I think we make a lot of assumptions about what could go wrong in a situation like this, but we don't maybe think enough about how well it could work if everybody understands that they have an investment in keeping this thing moving and keeping
right.
it going.
Well, right? You know, with the coronavirus, we have seen what happens when people who aren't used to being in need suddenly are, and there's, you know, toilet paper shortages and seed shortages right. and flour shortages, every, you know, so I don't think it's entirely unreasonable to be, to be a little trepidatious, but I found it so interesting that the fridge he mentioned is never empty because right. the demand is there. I'm sure there is a high demand, yep. but it's lovely
to me.
And
this about how people were taking ingredients and then returning cooked food.
With cooked food.
Oh, my heart started racing. What a lovely bit. And I wouldn't have thought that far down the road, but how wonderful that is existing and that people have taken those ingredients and provided cooked food for whoever it is that is sort of supporting or putting the fridge out there, you know, and making it available. And that connects to an important piece the author in this piece brought up, which is that this is about solidarity, not charity.
Yeah.
And I really love that distinction, right? It is the collective we are concerned about the food security of our community, and this is how we're going to do this, right? This is how we think this problem can be solved.
In the article, they talk about it like it's nothing, but this has got to be a high upkeep situation, you know?
Totally.
Like, I think about how many things in my fridge inadvertently go yes. bad, and or I can't remember when I, you know, when did I buy these eggs? You know, and he does mention, I think they clean it every morning. They do.
They tweet out
the inventory, but I'm sure they also have to have measures in place to, you know, communicate to people, you know, this is when these eggs were bought, yep. or this
some
is
sort
all
of
these
labeling and dating,
and especially with the cooked food. So it's just lovely seeing this kind of investment in the community and in your. What was the term? Hyper local
food security.
Amazing.
Right? I love it so much. I'm really getting excited about grassroots networks of people who care about each other. Right? That's it. That's what's going to get us through this. It's as simple as that. And I feel like I want to think about how I can get one of these beautiful fridges started because it makes a ton of sense.
For sure. Alinea is in the news again.
Indeed. Very, very curious bit.
I must admit, I was reading this article and what really struck me was this food experience that they're creating for people to have at home.
Yes.
I must admit, I was not very familiar with Alinea when I first read the article, and I'm hoping you might be able to provide some further insights.
Definitely.
But what I did see was this chef who usually creates this dessert on the table.
Yes.
And the dessert consists of various custards and chocolate sauces and berries.
Bits,
you know, nothing
of cake and things. Yeah.
You know, novel. You know, nothing out of the ordinary, let's say. But what is out of the ordinary is this presentation where it's like literally splattered on the table.
Very Jackson Pollock. Yes.
And then, you know, I think there's a big, the main part of the dessert is then plonked on top and you end up with this, you know, this gorgeous splattered situation. And so for the 15th anniversary of Alinea, they decided to turn this into an at-home experience. So you could order out this thing, which was a plastic sheet of some sort that you can put down.
Yes.
And then all the little different containers. And there's a video on Instagram that coaches you through the proper technique, which I found particularly entertaining. I don't know. I had a lot of different thoughts and feelings about this. I mean, the first one was how interesting this is, because when a restaurant does takeout, they're surrendering a lot of control, right? They're surrendering texture control, temperature control. They don't know if that person's going to go ahead and eat it or if they're going to put it in the fridge and then microwave it the next day.
Yep.
And this is the opposite, in a way the opposite, but in a way also, you know, creating this experience for people at home where they are treating the food that they take out differently and yes. thinking about plating it.
Yes.
And all that, which I thought was really cool, as long as I like blocked out the packaging, which was like
yes. Oh my
way
gosh.
Too many small plastic.
Way too many solo cups. It's the truth.
Containers.
It really is. So that Grant Achatz is the name of the chef, mm-hmm. You know, at Alinea in Chicago, hugely famous. And he was the first to do this, to offer this bit of theater with dessert that's plated right on the table, and people mm-hmm. just get spoons and they eat right off of the table. And everybody really effectively lost their minds the first time.
Well, it's
happened,
so right? visceral.
Totally. Yeah. And he's the kind of man, I think there's like edible balloons and all kinds of gorgeous things are happening in that menu. And so when I watch this in a video and he tells this whole story with lots of like serious legitimacy, right? There's no tongue in cheek involved at all. And then he shows you. And when you actually see this man roll out the acetate and pick up the strawberry custard and just chug, you know what I mean? And he does a definitive swipe on the table or, you know, from a height or whatever it is. And there's a part of me that was imagining, you know, a family of four at home with it, pulling this off on their own
yeah.
kitchen tables, right? And thinking, yeah, that could be a ton of fun. Right? That could be a lot of fun. Or it could be maybe that is not enough, right? If you're still doing it in your kitchen with your, you know what I mean? Without sort of right. the context of the restaurant and the starch white linens and all of it, is it the same experience? I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably not the same experience. But it's still a cool experience.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
I don't, you know, this gentleman, I agree with you from the video, very cerebral human being. Yeah. So I think he probably considered the very real possibility that people would have tons of fun Instagramming their
yes,
results.
Yes, truth.
And, you know, people are so used to Instagramming other people's plating. So it's really cool for them to now
right.
be sharing their own plating and maybe appreciating in a different way the kind of work that's involved
mm-hmm.
in doing these things. But yeah, I'm going to guess it's not the cheapest situation.
Oh my goodness, I'm sure not.
But you know, what a fun thing to do with the kids if it wasn't. And I'm sure you can, you know, just grab some peanut butter and Nutella and replicate and some yeah. marshmallows and replicate the
well,
situation.
Well, there is a sort of comedic full circle here, because on one April Fool's Day a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
Alinea actually put out a video about their takeout.
Really?
Right? And at the time, we had never imagined that a fine dining restaurant would ever consider takeout, mm-hmm. pre-pandemic, obviously. And it was this hilarious visual of these like bags and bags and bags of things. And then all they printed the instructions off of the POS. And it was just like long strips of paper with all these crazy instructions about like burn this rosemary and, you know, and
yeah.
all this crazy nonsense. And it was a joke. It was just an April Fool's Day. And everyone was like, oh, good on Alinea for making fun of themselves that way, right? And so to see...
Little did they know
that in a few years ahead of time, they'd actually be doing this for real is amazing. The other piece that I am noting, because I've seen a couple of my other chef pals who are doing takeout,
mm-hmm.
And they've done these videos on Instagram to show people how to plate, right? How to take things out of the
takeout
box.
This is all new to me.
Right.
This is this a thing that existed before?
No, this is a pandemic takeout thing because mm-hmm. restaurants that ordinarily wouldn't have done takeout are now doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason is because of the plating. Right. This is just not the vibe of this restaurant. So my friend JP has restaurants in Galway, JP McMahon, and he was doing this. And so it was like a chocolate tart
uh-huh.
that had a little container of sour cream or something. Right. And so he's there with the tart and he takes it out and the dollop of the sour cream on the side. And then I saw this other like mushroom dish that had this like pickled sea asparagus and some other little something. And I remember he and I were, when I was in Ireland, we were joking around because his daughters were watching these unboxing videos, right? There's these
wow.
videos of people unwrapping gifts
yeah.
or whatever. And apparently
yeah.
we are really excited about watching people open boxes.
I don't
right?
know who
and
is,
he,
but it's a real
I
thing.
I have no idea, but I think young people are.
Yeah.
And so he and I were being like really like hilarious and dismissive. And then I saw this video and I was noting how curious it was that I, like it said chocolate tart on the box. And I still sat there watching the video being like, what's inside? What's gonna, what you got? Right. And so I sent him a message saying, wasn't it just a year and a half ago that we were, you know, rolling our eyes about unboxing videos and now you're shooting some of your very own? And he obviously had a good laugh in return. And so there's a weird little cultural pulse involved in all of this. And the fact that the way chefs are making this work is this little explanation about like, here, when you order the sauteed mushrooms, here's how to put it together in your house again.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be interesting if this was yet another side effect of or another effect of this isolation period on the food industry, just a totally. Bigger appreciation on the consumer side of how to treat the food once it's brought home.
There's something there. Right?
Yeah. You know, I'm not saying you should plate everything that, you know, that you
sometimes just eat that burger out of the paper container and that's fine.
But at least, you know, putting more thought into that side of things.
It's and that experience is about more than just a visual look.
Uh-huh.
Right? That's about how you eat it and how the mouthfuls, you know, come together depending on how you've plated it.
Josh and I came across this article, and I just have to mention that the article was planned out by this low-calorie ice cream brand. So
okay, it's important to note.
It colored a little bit my view of it, but you know, different companies are always looking for interesting hooks to get people to write articles. And what this particular company did is they hired a sensory scientist to teach us to properly eat ice cream.
Tell me more.
Are you ready for the instructions?
Please.
Okay. The first step I actually think is an excellent step, which is take your ice cream out 15 minutes before you're going to eat it.
Right.
I mean, unless your freezer is not, my freezer is not very cold, so I can pull it right out. But, you know, there's some truth in the fact that if something is too cold, you can't appreciate its flavor. Mm-hmm. Also, the texture is wrong.
Yeah, it's not easy on the teeth. Yeah.
And then it crosses into, I'm not so sure.
I'm with
you. So here is apparently the proper way to eat ice cream.
Let's have it.
Scoop out half a teaspoon.
No.
Half a teaspoon. Put the teaspoon upside down on your tongue, which I also like because you're getting that tongue contact. Move the ice cream around. Inhale through your mouth, which I'm assuming is that that wine technique.
Yeah,
you know that
totally.
Like wine slurping,
100%.
Which I am not entirely convinced works with ice cream, but I haven't tried it. And then this, you should be keeping this half a teaspoon of ice cream in your mouth for 12 seconds to fully appreciate this flavor.
It's insane.
Before moving on to your next half a teaspoon.
Come on. No. It's ludicrous.
Listen, I understand that if you are evaluating this ice cream and you need to take very careful and detailed notes on its flavor profile, this might be the proper technique. But I don't know. I feel like it's taking the joy out of the entire situation.
100%. I am with you. As somebody who has enjoyed sitting with an ice cream cone, just licking away to my heart's content, why, like the whole point of an ice cream cone is that a spoon need not be involved.
Right.
Right? The delight of just cone, your mouth, and you're dealing with it.
And if you're going half a teaspoon at a time in your licks, that's going to melt all over your hand.
All over. All over. It's really laughable. And I mean, I tried to understand. I think you're right to point out that the diet angle is important because this is like if your portion is only a half a cup of something and it's in a bowl because you can't eat the cone.
Yeah.
Right? The cone is too many carbs. So it's in a bowl and this is very, so you want to like maximize all of the pleasure.
It seems to really be encouraging disordered eating habits.
I think so too. Especially because it's not just milk and cream in there, in their sort of diet-friendly ice cream.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And the reason that's important is that real milk and cream will actually do a beautiful linger on your tongue.
Good right? point.
Real milk fat will actually do something impressive worth paying attention to on your tongue. But any sort of simulated facsimile will be quite a disappointment after 3 seconds, let's say.
But, so well, maybe it's because you're not enjoying it properly, Josh. No?
Oh, good point. Good point. Out of all of it, I thought to myself, I was like, what's the most useful piece here? And I was like, the most useful piece is step number one.
Yeah.
Right? Is the thing that people don't connect to, which is that flavors are muted in the cold.
Yeah.
So warm them up a little bit and they will blossom in a way that is a bit more enjoyable.
Yeah. And I also appreciate if you're using a spoon, you know, put the ice cream down on your tongue instead of putting the spoon on your tongue. Although it's all going to melt in there anyway.
The roof of your mouth.
Yeah.
But there's something nice about the intentional delivery to the tongue.
But I also feel like that's instinctive. I was thinking about when I eat ice cream, I always flip that spoon gets flipped
too.
Around.
Yep, I do too.
Our bodies know how to eat ice cream. That's what I'm saying.
The children inside of us knew how to eat ice cream.
That's right. But here you go. If anyone wants to take it to the next level.
And be really thoughtful about it.
Or conduct an odd experiment. These are times of boredom.
Indeed, you know? This is occupied.
Give it a shot.
Ice cream tasting in quarantine.
If you're enjoying our podcast, please support us at patreon.com/hotplatepod. Hot Plate is part of the Frequency Podcast Network. Please consider leaving us a rating or review. It helps others find us. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Hot Plate Pod. Follow me at Beerology on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And follow Joshna at Joshna Maharaj on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Original music by Dave Bell. Hot Plate is produced by Mirella Amato, that's me, and Dennis Coyne. Thanks for listening.